everything's open for question. And just an outset, I'm a geologist. I was a young field geologist at the time that this happened. I think I was very naive in the process of the legal system. I think I was, at that time, a true scientist, and I felt that science was, you know, the scientific facts were indisputable, and that when a fact was a fact, that you looked at it a certain way, and there was no debate on that fact. And I've learned a very hard lesson from there that's carried me forward in the rest of my professional life. I'm still an environmental consultant. I still do environmental consulting. And the experience I went through in Woburn, both gathering the evidence and presenting the evidence to a jury, has really cemented the way that I approach my professional life these days, and that I can look at something as a fact, and I can realize that someone else can see it as not a fact. And I really welcome the opportunity to do this, and I'm humbled by the people that are here. And for me, it's sort of a very surreal experience to be in the same building, in the same room with some people who were trying to rip the top of my head off. But anyhow, we'll go on. This is just sort of a summary. I'll give you maybe an introduction, which we just did. We'll talk a little about the site history and locus, some of the field activities, site documentation, the trial preparation, and the trial itself, which Mr. Fascia really said was a bottomless pit. And I do agree with him that it was a bottomless pit. And then aftermath and the questions and answers. But I want to open this up to, you know, right from the get-go, questions and answers and things like that. So before I start, though, I just want to show a couple of quick slides of what the field conditions looked like, what was actually out at the site, and what we found. Unfortunately, all the documentation that I collected, I gave to Jan and the folks at Strickland, Conway, and Crowley, and as you know from reading the book, all that stuff was destroyed. So I have only skerrigs of information that I've retained. So let's take a quick look at these slides, and we'll get on with the questions and answers, anything like that. Can everyone see this? Basically, this is the Beatrice property, and just shows the installation of one of the monitoring wells right across from well G. This is, I think you've all read in the book and the depositions in the movie, that what Beatrice property looked like, the 15 acres for indigenous wildlife. This is one of the crushed drums that were on the property. This is actually the fall of 1985. So this is what the site looked like in the fall of 1985. I have not been back there since then. I know that EPA and other folks have been out there cleaning up the site. But this is sort of the site conditions when we first got on there to do our investigation. Again, more drums and barrels. This is the infamous debris pile E. And this debris pile showed up in air photographs from 1956, 1960, 1965, and 1972. So when you looked at the air photographs, on the physical geographical location on the ground surface, that pile has been in there since the early 60s, mid-50s. And incidentally, this is one of the debris piles that had high levels of trichloroethylene in it. Again, just another shot of the woods, you know, very heavily wooded. You can see if this was under full vegetation, I may not be able to see some of these drums and barrels. Again, this is an interesting picture. This is some drums in the weeds here, but you'll notice these little white cans here. Those are beer cans, and they were actually Budweiser beer cans. And we called the Budweiser company to try to figure out when these beer cans were manufactured. We assume that, you know, most beer cans don't have a long shelf life. You know, they buy them and people drink them very quickly. And it was interesting talking to the folks from Budweiser that these cans were cans that were made in the mid-60s. So it sort of helped us date what was going on. And the logic here was that a beer can is not something someone's going to stay from the mid-60s to the 80s and throw out in 1984 or 1985. That it would be logical, and this is one of the things we need to think about, that it was probably disposed of at the time of the manufacture of the beer cans. Yes, sir. That's probably about, I would say, 200 feet off Salem Street. I'll show a map showing you where that location is. This is some of the monitoring wells that are installed. These are the wells right here. And if you look on, this is from the Beatrice property. If you look across, that's the Abrajona River. And then on the top there is the other side where wells G and H. So it's a distance of maybe 600-700 feet. It's not that great of a distance. This is an interesting shot. This is from Well H, looking over to the smokestack of the John J. Reilly tannery. Now that stack is no longer there, and the area has been redeveloped, and now it's an industrial park. This is a shot looking over to that's Well G there, and this outhouse type of structure is where when USGS were, this is during the pup test, and because of security issues, all the instrumentation was locked up in these porta potties. As a matter of fact, we had our own instruments out there during the 30-day pump test, and we had a trailer on site. And one night around midnight, we're in the trailer watching the drawdown during the pump test, and all our instruments went dead. So we went running out to find out what was going on, and it turns to find out that someone took an axe and cut all our cables in the field, and we had to get some new equipment, Federal Express, in the next day. So after that, we hired a full-time security to guard all our equipment. Again, this is monitoring wells and some of the groundwater monitoring equipment. More monitoring wells, just to show that the Beaches property, we did some significant amount of subsurface investigation, and actually the plaintiff spent a considerable amount of money investigating the property, and it was a very, very comprehensive and thorough groundwater and groundwater chemistry investigation. It was needed to really understand the chemistry and the flow. And I don't know if you folks were here earlier, but when you heard Dr. Gusworth talk, this particular property, the Wildwood 15 acres, Beatrice or Reilly property, whatever you want to call it, is the most contaminated property in the entire area. As a matter of fact, when you walk around there, you can smell the chemicals. The smell is actually in some locations quite high. And in one location, we had a sample that looked very strange. We took it to the laboratory, and it was the highest level of pesticides the laboratory had ever seen. They actually shut all their equipment down. We had approximately 400 parts per million of chlordane, which is a banned substance right now. Just more of the weeds out there showing when it's under full vegetation. It's difficult to see some of the drums and barrels. Again, part of debris pile E with some monitoring wells in the background. And this is one of my favorite pictures. That chap with the red hat in the trench there is Jan Schlickman. And this is on the back of the W.R. Grace property. And that's Jan really got into it. He was in the trenches. When we found things, he'd get out there and be looking at them. And I'm not sure under current conditions this is an appropriate OSHA protocol for sampling the field, but I think I put this in here to show that Jan was very dedicated to the cause. He was out there just about every day. He was very, very interested in what we found, and when we found something significant, he was, I would say, an individual with incredible enthusiasm. And some of the low points of the field investigation, he was sort of a guiding light to keep us all going. His enthusiasm to trying to find out what was going on was amazing. And that's that for that. We can put the lights back on. And getting back to your question, location, I'll just give you a rough idea how all this felt fits together here. This is a copy of the USGS topographic sheet. And wells G and H are right there. The Grace property is right here. The Beaches property is here. So it was approximately about 500, 600 feet in from the road where the barrels and drums were found. And maybe it's another, this is probably a good one to show also. This map is basically from NUS, which was an EPA contractor working in the field. And you can see here's Salem Street here. There's the scale. It's probably couple hundred feet, and the drums were basically along this road here on either side of the road, and the drums were littered in there. And after the fact, we couldn't figure out why, you know, you have scattered pockets of drums and a sort of debris all over the place. It almost seemed to be random disposal. And after everything was over, we came to find out that obviously there was a removal activity, And what we were looking at was the residuum of an apparent effect to get all the material off. And one of the more infamous samples we found was the sample Z, which is talked about in the book. And sample Z was found in this area here. And as you walked around the site, you just find these little clumps of very strange-looking material. And my initial background is in chemistry, but geology is my true calling. And it just looked unusual. And you would pick it up and it would have a leather-like odor. It was definitely a distinct odor. When we analyzed the material, it was sort of a peaty type of material. It had high chrome, high TCE, and we just found these little clumps around the site. So it was really intriguing to try to put all this together because there was no documentation, at least that we knew, that there had been any disposal activity from the tannery. Yes, sir. Okay, Grace would be way up here off that, on the other side of the river. So let me go back to, just bear with me here. It's not a good USGS let me down here. This is the 15 acres right here, this location. The Abergeona River flows through here like this. I don't know if you can see it that clearly. And then the Grace property would be up in this area here. So Grace is approximately half a mile from Wells G&H on the other side of the river. And up the hill. Actually, I have a good, this is a cross section from USGS. Chuck Mayette, who's a great colleague and a great hydrogeologist, he was the chap who did all the investigations for USGS out in the field. And he's the individual who conducted the pump test. Grace would have been up here. See where it says Washington Street? Well, W.R. Grace would be this location here. This is a cross-section through the Abergeona River Valley. So what we're looking at is assume this is a piece of cake. We cut a cross-section through the piece of cake. And what we're showing is the various lithology, the sands, the gravels, and the bedrock that are out in the Abergeona River Valley. The Beatrice or Wildwood property is right here where it says Boston and Maine, and then the tannery was right here. So what the U.S. Geological Survey has done with this particular cross-section is show the subsurface geology, the approximate location of the various responsible parties, and also the groundwater flow pattern. So this is sort of a very instructive figure to look at. Yes, sir. Yes, Universe would be in the same groundwater system, but if you take this slice, Universe would be maybe a foot on the other side of the wall. So that's and the other property, Olympia Nominee Trust, would have been just up that way. So Olympia's that way, Universe was that way. Okay? Yes, Scott. Right. We did go up in there. You know, we didn't know exactly where all these boundaries were in the field, but the southern part of Olympia Nominee Trust property looked exactly like the Beatrice property. There were drums and same sort of unusual-like looking material. There was no fence. No, there was no fence. So it looked like, going back to this NUS drawing here. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. Okay. No, unless something comes up. I'd like to make this interactive with the audience because I think from the last session, people didn't want to hear a speech. They wanted to ask questions. Did that answer, Scott, did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess just before, the personal point of this, of being a field geologist, I sort of got involved in trying to figure out what was at the surface and using my knowledge of exploration geology, trying to date and map what had happened. And the protocols and the processes we use are the standard that one would use in the industry to try to figure out what's going on, sort of like urban archaeology. And as a side note, on some of the things that we did find on the Beatrice property, we found newspapers from the 60s, election campaign posters from the 60s. In one instance, we had a tree growing out of one of the debris piles. So we cut the tree down and did a tree ring analysis and found that the tree was at least 15 years old. So the evidence was really starting to solidify that, you know, the disposal activities are happening in the late 50s, mid 60s. And the key issue was we knew all that debris was there. When did the chemicals get deposited there? And the defendant's, questioning of me was how did I know that they would agree that the debris was there, but how did the chemicals get there? And their argument to me is that someone could have come in 1983 and dumped the chemicals on the debris pile, which is a good argument. But it didn't make sense that you have all these little debris piles and all these little skerrigs of weird-looking material around the property. Every time you pick one up and analyze it, it had the same chemicals in it. So it didn't seem logical that these midnight dumpers in 1983 would come around to each one of these little areas and dump the same chemicals on each little component. So logic, and I'm using logic, sometimes it doesn't work in a courtroom, as I'm well aware, that it made a logical sense that the debris and the chemicals were correlatable in time and in chemistry. And, yes, sir? Yes, they were. I don't think, I'm not sure if anyone asked that question, but being involved in drilling wells, this is not the material that's a residue of well drilling. Usually when you get residue of well drilling, you get powdered rock or soil or mud. This is E with a difference, real peaty type of material. When you break it open, it had an odor that I said was leather-like. I mean, someone else may say it's different, but it was a musty, leather-like odor that was very unusual. And, you know, doing enough environmental sampling and analysis, when you find something like that, you know it's not naturally occurring. Because when you open up mud or naturally occurring soil, it has a different type of odor and texture. Yes, sir?
I guess a couple of questions. One, did you look at the Industriflex site, which would that be up further? And then two, were there any buried piles of hides that would mean that you just found some old rotting hide, which might be the leather-like substance?
I personally did not look at the industrial plex property, but we did look at the chemistry throughout the river basin, and especially for the volatile organics. When you get north of wells G and H, the volatile organics dropped off. So it didn't seem like that industrial plex was at least bringing volatile organics down into the wells G and H area. Now, subsequently, MIT is doing a comprehensive analysis of the river valley, and they're finding arsenic and chromium. But that's in the sediments, and typically metals like arsenic and chromium adhere to the sediments, and they don't really migrate to the groundwater column that quickly.
John, Eric is going to hook up another microphone so that we can get the audience questions better. It'll take him a minute or two to do it.
You had a second question, too.
And I think we should just continue questioning, and we'll pick it up as we go. But you got to get good sound as best you can.
Was the leather smelling substance old leather?
That, I'm not a leather chemist, but it definitely had silicone in it. So really, it looked like it. But there were no hides or any, I would say, heavy-duty tanning type of materials on the Beecher's property. There were some strange-looking wire brushes and strange-looking materials that were in the 55-gallon drums. There were some strange-looking sludges. There was just a lot of unique-looking material that... as I said earlier, I'm still an environmental consultant. I haven't seen material like that since, and I've been on a lot of sites that are pretty nasty. This was an unusual collection of materials that just didn't seem to fit that particular property. I'll come down here.
I was wondering what you thought of the questions that were asked of the jury after the waterwork phase, and whether or not, you could have answered them, and whether or not you could.
I could not have answered those questions, and I think I know one of the jurors is here, but I'm not going to put her on the spot. But I think there were questions that I don't even think Dr. Guster could answer those questions. And I think the questions were, patently unfair. There's no way that a normal person could answer those questions. They were just structured to just befuddle the normal human being. I think even a PhD would have a very difficult time answering those questions. Specifically for month and year, I don't think there's any computer model out there that would really give you that sort of precision. And that's the only way you would approach that. The human being couldn't really come up with that type of answer. So I think the questions were very difficult for the jury, and I don't know where they came from. It didn't make sense to me. Dan?
John, several years after the trial, it was revealed that John Riley and his lawyer had improperly withheld documents from the plaintiffs during the discovery period. Two questions coming from that. First of all, I wonder if you could tell us how that might have changed your investigation if Riley and his lawyer had not engaged in that deliberate misconduct. And the second part of that is a little bit more speculative. I think the case against Beatrice really fell apart because George Kinder did not present a credible model of groundwater as well. I wonder if you have any thoughts on whether, if Riley and his lawyer had not engaged in that misconduct, whether it might have helped Kinder produce a better.
Okay, Dan. I do have a sort for two. I did bring that report, and I actually read it last night again. I think it would have changed at least the way I looked at what was going on. I mean, this happened way after the fact, and we weren't even aware that these wells or this chemistry existed on the Riley Tannery property. And it would have changed a lot of things. One, we would have put water level measuring devices in those wells to monitor what happened during the pump test, because that whole part of the Beaches property was never monitored. And there's a sort of a funny story with that there were two existing EPA wells to the west of the Beaches property that were supposed to be monitored, and they were never monitored. For some reason, they fell through the crack, and I'm not sure what happened. I think there would have been key wells for drawdown analysis. The other question is the chemistry of the wells in the that report indicated very trace levels of breakdown products of chlorinated solvents, specifically TCE and PCE. And with that knowledge, even though the levels were very low, it would have made us at least take a stronger and harder look at what was going on. There was a taste that something was in the groundwater. And groundwater is an excellent way of really measuring what's happening in the soil. So if you start getting traces of chemicals in the groundwater, you know something is going on. The second question, it would have definitely changed our approach, at least my approach. I don't know what would happen in the, in the getting permission to get on that property. It probably would have helped Dr. Pinder. I know Dr. Pinder had a hard time in witnessing, and I wasn't there. I feel that he was trying to document what was going on. He had problems with what was going on in the river, and I think from my reading the testimony in the book, he had a hard time explaining where the missing flow went, and he assumed that the river wasn't contributing to the wells GNH. I think subsequently USGS determined either 30 or 40% of it did get there. I do have a funny story to tell about that, because I remember one night in Jan's office trying to figure out how we were going to show the jury what happened under pumping these wells and where the water was going. And I remember Charlie Nesson, this is going to be a story about you, Charlie, so trying to figure out how we would make the jury understand what was happening. A very complex hydrologic theory. You pump the wells and the water comes out of the ground and how it all interacts. And I remember Charlie coming back one night with this big plexiglass model with all the wells and GNH in there. And he had water in it. And he started pumping the wells GNH. It showed the whole system coming down. It was very, very powerful example of what happens to the aquifer under pumping. And I don't know, Charlie, did I ever go to trial? I don't know if it ever showed up or not. But it did. Okay. Okay. See, I wasn't there for that. Okay. So it was, an interesting collaboration of science and the attorneys, because the scientists were not having a good way of showing this, and Charlie jumped in there right away in a very visual effect. So, that's something I just learned, anyhow.
John, this is so much more attractive than the last one. If you have a question, you raise your hand, and then I'll see who you are, and then we'll have it on the tape. Otherwise, you don't hear the answer.
Oh, okay. I'm... I've heard the evidence, and, you know, I haven't really reviewed it. Dr. Guswa presented the evidence. I have tremendous respect for him, and not really viewing the evidence, I really can't say. You know, but it would seem that, you know, the contamination has come from somewhere, and I think from what I've seen in the field, it's clear that the Beatrice property, of all the properties in the area, were the more highly contaminated. And not looking at the data, I just can't comment on it. You know. Yes, sir.
One big issue for the whole legal system, and Andrew is understanding things like this, and one of the best ways of thinking possible for them to have hope of understanding cases like this. And I guess I'd like a reaction on whether the jury is capable of understanding cases like this. And second, would it help to have several detailed questions as opposed to questions you have? Or would it be better to ask the jury the question very holistically? Do they cause damage?
Well, I think the juries can understand what's going on, and I think we're all, you know, juries are us. We're looking at juries right now, people in this room. We are the jury pool, and I think we're capable of understanding complex theories and what's going on. I think we're not capable of understanding how the law system works and how objections and the sidebars and what's going on, and I don't think as normal citizens we're prepared for that. We're not prepared for long hours. I mean, I spent a couple of days in the witness stand just reading analytical results into the record. And I think that doesn't really advance the ball. I understand the game, but I think it confuses the jury. I think they're capable of answering the questions that are put for them in a succinct and common sense manner. But when the questions are put forward that are very complex that even scientists can't answer, then I think we're putting an undue burden on the jury. I think the jury system worked to the best of their ability in this case, but I think there are a lot of extenuating circumstances that made it difficult for them to know everything that's going on. And I know one of the jurors can have a session later, and I think you should ask her that question. Yeah, I'm not going to put her on the spot here. But I think asking the holistic question, as a scientist, I would say yes. I mean, I think most of you folks in this room are legal scholars, attorneys, and law students, and I don't know if science can be dictating to law how trials get carried forth, but it would be nice, and this is sort of an idealistic point of view, that the legal system sort of mimics what the rest of society is like, and I'm not sure sometimes it happens that way. Yes, sir.
I'd like to follow up on that last question from the standpoint of the scientist making the inquiry as to whether there was a connection between the sites and the solution of the well. Did you find the process that you went through in terms of being a partisan advocate or a partisan investigator and a duel with other partisan investigators on the other side testifying?
That's a very good question. I didn't view myself as a partisan person. I viewed myself as someone trying to go out and find the facts, and that the facts were more important. And if the facts didn't support what was going on, I would have said, you don't have a case, that the facts are superseding. And I know that in this situation where the expert is considered partisan, I just consider myself a geologist. I consider myself an expert, a geologist with the facts. And in my own naivete, I felt the facts would be get to the truth. And the facts were there. I think what happened in the legal system is that the facts get molded, I guess.
But John, when you say the facts are there, the one big fact that wasn't there, which was the whole cleanup operation on Beatrice.
Right.
So you had to do your entire thing in the absence of the knowledge that the whole thing, absence of proof that the whole thing had been through a cleanup.
Right. We were trying to take what we could see in the field and, I won't say fabricate a story, but put together a story that was logical to the jury to understand what happened. I think after all this was done, the facts came out. I'm not sure of the truth behind the facts came out. We're not sure really what happened on the Riley property and Beecher's property. I think the record on what happened on the Grace property is a lot clearer. We have, you know, obviously testimony from the Grace employees. We have air photographs. We have the excavations that were conducted out back. So the Grace story is a more factual and truthful story that we knew what's going on, at least after everything's done. I mean, there was something going on with the employees not being truthful, and that was unfortunate. But on the Riley Beatrice property, we don't have any, until after everything's done, we had no linkage what was going on. Oh, okay. Touche. Yes, sir. Well, the barrels are actually quite critical because under the Department of Transportation, most 55-gallon drums have to have date stamps on them, and stamps of manufacture. So by looking at the date stamps and dates of manufacture of these barrels and 55-gallon drums, we could show that they were constructed or manufactured in the 50s and 60s. So that gave us some idea of what was going on. So the fact that the barrels there and what was in them, some had beer cans and trash, they really gave us an archaeological, so to speak, record of what was going on. So they were actually critical into determining what was happening. Oh, okay, that would have been critical to see, because I think that would have been a wealth of data and evidence that would have really helped pinpoint what's going on. What we were looking at was the remnants of a major removal operation, and we were, as I said in the beginning, we were trying to figure out why we had these little areas of debris and stuff spread around the site. It just didn't make sense. But after the fact, everything was done, it's clear that there was a massive removal operation to try to make the site look like conservation land. Yes, sir. Well, I think a lot of things have changed. I'd say since early 80s when Superfund was enacted in, I don't know how many of you folks are from Massachusetts, there's a local statute, 21E, which really puts severe penalties on people for doing that type of activity. I think the other thing is things like Love Canal and unfortunately Woburn and Times Beach and other things like that have really heightened corporations for corporate responsibility. And I think we see from that time forward that, you know, corporations, they realize they're part of the community they work in. They live in a community. Their kids go to school. They drink the water. So corporate responsibility has really been heightened. Not that people still don't do that. We still have evidence of you know, people who try to circumvent the law, and 9 times out of 10 they get caught, not all the time. But, you know, I think we have changed. We're more respectful of the environment, and I think we're more understanding of the activities that we do have not only an impact in our backyard, but things can migrate and affect someone miles away. So I think there's been a fundamental shift in how we deal with the chemicals around us. And I think the other thing that happened that, you know, in the 50s and 60s, you know, chemicals were our friends, you know, better living through chemistry. And I think we've come to understand that we have to have respect for some of these things that make our everyday lives more easier, but we have to make sure that we dispose of those residues in an appropriate manner. Oh, okay. Yes, sir.
Are you familiar with the cleanup operation out there that the EPA is proposing?
Just very, very vague. I'll try to answer the question.
What is the technical process for cleaning up this kind of site?
Okay. I think the cost probably would have been $70 million. It would probably be, you know, some function less than that because things are cheaper than now. I'm not sure it probably would have been done effectively because in the 70s the laws were in a place to handle the materials that they hauled off site. You know, apparently 2,000 yards of soil were hauled off site, 60 tons of hazardous sludge. That probably would have been taken to some landfill someplace that probably wasn't lined or capped and would have caused a problem somewhere else. So now with the technology and the laws in place, those type of materials are taken to secure facilities. The technology to use are basically pumping the groundwater, treating it, and using sort of like a big vacuum system to suck all the volatile organics out of the ground. So the technologies are there now. So when we do have these type of sites that are found, the technologies are there to clean it up. I would say in the case of Wells G&H, I would guess that aquifer will never ever be used again for drinking water. One, from a technical reason, and two, for a political reason. I think it would be political suicide for that community to use that as an aquifer. Yes, sir. Not being involved in the process, I think there is definitely a reason to clean it up because these contaminants have the potential to migrate to the surface water and to affect the ecosystem. So whether we clean it, I can't count for EPA, but whether we clean it to drinking water standard or a standard to protect the ecosystem, you know, something needs to be done. And for the corporations to allow this to happen, just to leave it in place, I think that would be, you know, both environmentally and politically and socially not acceptable to leave those type of materials there because there's still potential exposures for children or someone, you know, trespassers. So it's definitely appropriate to address it. The question you're asking, what degree do we clean it up? And I really don't have the answer to that, but it should be cleaned up.
Yeah. Okay, I should ask my question. I wanted to ask you to comment on the issue of the credentials of scientists in the trials. In the book, seen with you, unfortunately, is that scene in which Hodger is cross-examining you and making you feel about some things in your resume.
Right.
I was wondering, from your perspective, if you think that credentials are overblown in legal trials and whether or not that affected what experts were used in this trial and what experts are actually testifying in legal trials. Whether or not the scientists who are testifying are ones whose credentials are perfect, but maybe substantively.
That's a very good question. Well, fortunately, I did have my degree, and so that it was. I think it shows what a witness has to go through. That I think, you know, what we see happening in Washington is also a reflection of that. That we're all human beings. We all have different foibles in our background. I think it's important that people who are testifying do have the credentials that they say they do, and that they are truly experts in what they're doing, at least knowledgeable experts. Are they greater experts than me on the science of geology? Dr. Guswer is levels above me. I mean, there's so many people who have greater qualifications, a greater knowledge in hydrogeology and groundwater fate and transport than I do. That's, I think you just want someone who's credible, someone who understands what's happening in the field and someone who can present in a credible way to the jury that what the facts are. And I think that's the most important thing. Yes, sir.
In terms of the case, my understanding from what you're saying is you really were involved in two parts of proving the case. It would have been, first of all, to try to get some proof that the dumping had gone on. And secondly, had the chemicals, if they were dumped, how did they wind up into the water supply?
Right.
In terms of the conclusions you reached, were there some of the conclusions you felt which were more questionable than others? I mean, did you find that you would have strong evidence that you felt was pretty controversial in terms of the dumping? Did you have some question that whether the dumping had made its way into the water supply?
I felt that the dumping had taken place at the time, and I felt using geologic principles and scientific logic that had happened at that time. There was no doubt it got into the groundwater because we could drill wells right next to where the debris piles were, and we'd find the same chemicals that we'd find in the debris pile. So to my mind, there was no doubt that the dumping happened and they got to the groundwater. I guess the next critical thing was getting it from the groundwater up to wells G and H. I think on the Beatrice property, there was no doubt that it happened because a couple of days after the wells were turned on, you could see the wells had dropped a couple of feet. It's amazing. And you'd be measuring the water level and just sort of sitting there, and then you come back the next day and boom, it's gone down a couple of feet. So you know it had to go somewhere. And that was Dr. Pinder's charge. Another interesting thing happened also that the day that the pump test started, the entire Abergeona River had frozen over. And the next morning we went out there and the ice had actually dropped down. And that was a key that, something unusual was going on. And that's where Dr. Pinder was, he was trying to explain what had happened to that drop in the water level that caused the ice to subside. And, USGS later indicated that, some percentage of the water that went to wells G&H came from the surface water. But I felt very comfortable with that, and I wouldn't have put myself through that tremendous ordeal if I didn't feel it was doable, because I know under cross-examination that I'd look like a fool. And it's the last thing I wanted to do was get up in front of a courtroom full of people to look like a fool. I would not have done it. If I didn't feel confident what I was saying was correct, then I would say no. It doesn't get the plaintiff's cause any further, and it doesn't justify my testimony. It just makes everything lose credibility, and that wasn't the goal. So that's I feel very strong about that. Okay. That's a good question. I don't think there's anything would have done differently. I'm not sure that I felt that Jan had an unlimited budget. We were trying to be very prudent. I mean, still in our, as a consultant today, you're trying to get the answers quickly and cost effectively as possible. I didn't look at this as a financial boondoggle. I looked at it as a way to get to the facts and what was going on. I think the only thing we would have done different was probably look a little bit harder at the tannery, because we had some evidence that what was going on there. Probably, now the problem is now the science has become so much more sophisticated. Analytical techniques become so much sophisticated. So some of those materials that we found, it would have been nice to do different types of analysis on. But at that time, the equipment wasn't really there, and some parts of fate and transport modeling in the early 80s weren't as advanced as they are now. We have better understanding of degradation of chlorinated compounds, and so the whole the state of the art has really migrated further. And so it's hard to go backwards, because now you have the 1999 focus going back to 1985, 86, and I think what we did at that time was appropriate. Well, I guess the hard lesson from Woburn to me is there's a difference between law and justice. And I know there are a lot of attorneys in the room, and they may not like to hear that, but I think there's a fundamental difference between law and justice. Was the law served in this instance? Not being attorney, but from what everyone tells me, the law probably was served because there are a lot of lawyers looking at this. Was justice served? Probably not. I don't think justice was served. But that's the dichotomy in our system, and I think I came away with a strong knowledge that, you know, science and law sometimes don't mix. It's like oil and water, and it's unfortunate because I think there's room for science and law to work together. I guess I came away, I went into this as a naive young geologist that thought science was paramount and the facts are the facts. And I came away, as I think I said earlier, that, you know, two people can look at the same set of facts and come up with a different opinion. And it's really made me think about what, you know, what's it all about. And the other job I have, I'm a municipal official in my community. And it sort of made me look at the things I adjudicate on and how we go forward with municipal issues on, you know, trying to be fair, but also working within the framework of the law. And it's sometimes very difficult because you're affecting people's lives who want to put an addition on their garage or some dog that bit someone, and you're trying to decide where you're going to put the dog down, what's fair and what's the law say. So it was, to me, a very humbling experience. And it taught me a lot about, I think, myself. I think that's what I came away. The other thing I came away with was that my role in this was so minuscule that the personal tragedies out there far outweigh, you know, what I went through in the witness stand, what I went through in the field. That you know, I think the key that I came away with all this is social responsibility, and that, you know, all of us corporations, lawyers, scientists, do, you know, we just really need to be socially responsible in what we do in our day-to-day activities. Right. Not knowing all the facts, I think from what they said, at least 2% of their water probably got to the well. So 2% of the water is there. So that means they were part of causing contamination well. I think it's clear that a large majority of what got to the wells was coming from the Beecher's property. When you look at the chemistry, the closeness, how severely contaminated that property was, and the levels of chlorinated solvents in the Beecher's property was far outweigh anything within that river system. So I still stand by, say, the law and justice were two different things, and maybe the law was served in this instance, but clearly justice was not.
John, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.